Psychedelics such as LSD, magic mushrooms, and ayahuasca can induce intense experiences that are very similar to spiritual or mystical experiences. For this reason, they have been, and in some nature-based religions still are, deliberately used in rituals or ceremonies. But how does this translate to our Western cultural context, which is shaped above all by Christianity and modernity? When are psychedelic experiences beneficial for our spiritual lives? And when might they be more harmful? For example, because we identify with these intense experiences and overvalue them. I spoke about these questions with Victor Givanescu. Victor has been working for several years as a facilitator for the integration of psychedelic experiences and has, for example, collaborated with the Berlin-based Mind Foundation and the UK-based Aleph Trust. I hope you enjoy the talk. Hallo und herzlich willkommen zu Was glaubst du denn? Dem Podcast über die Vielfalt des spirituellen Lebens von und mit Daniel Herbstreit. Hi Victor, welcome to the show.
Hi Daniel, thanks for having me here.
Thanks for being here. I want to talk to you about psychedelics today and about the connections between psychedelics and spirituality or spiritual experiences. And let's start with a basic question, because psychedelics like LSD or magic mushrooms, ayahuasca, have become very popular in recent years, especially in cities like Berlin. And some people even claim we're in the middle of a psychedelic renaissance. If we are or not, it's not so important at the moment, but it's pretty clear that psychedelics are very en vogue, pretty hip in certain circles at the moment. Do you have an explanation for that?
That's an interesting observation. I think it's partly true. They are quite en vogue now, and it's hard to see any one particular reason. I think it's more of a collection of different reasons. For example, there's been a lot of scientific advance in the last 20 years. So then in that there is really a resurgence and a renaissance and a number of articles and publications that have come. And that has also also to the works of people like Michael Pollan and the Netflix documentary, this became much more into the public's awareness, and it spread much more also due to social media. So I think this has something to do with it. Other reasons are also we're in an ecological crisis. We're in a crisis of meaning, and people are a bit, let's say, maybe from what I observe, maybe a bit kind of don't feel like they're getting their guidance from more traditional institutions and are more eager and keen, maybe even desperate to go for more direct experience, a more direct route of experiencing. And I think psychedelics are being also marketed as that. And last but not least, I think in Berlin, it's also a specific thing because it has to do with the culture of the city, and it's a place where there's a lot of experimentation. So I think naturally also in a place like this, you would have more interest into things that are also trending, also kind of have this like potential to open one up.
You just mentioned opening up through taking psychedelics. I would say that's one of the benefits that you can have when taking psychedelics. What are more potential benefits in your view?
So I would first of all start with a qualification here and a big disclaimer that these benefits do not manifest automatically. They could come in the right kind of environment and with the right kind of set and setting. And most of them, let's say, would come into being, deeper come into being in the integration phase and what happens after. But let's say on a best day for psychedelics, you could have, yes, an increase, as I said, in openness, a deeper sense of meaning, a deeper kind of felt sense of interconnectedness, a deeper appreciation and understanding of nature, increased creativity, increased capacity to just simply kind of feel and get in touch with oneself on a, let's say this would be on a personal level, and not even talking about the therapeutic benefits. I mean, that's also like been researched already, and we know that there are stable and clear benefits in terms of things, conditions like depression or addiction, or also in end of life care. So yeah, I would say there are both personal and therapeutic benefits. And I'm sure many could name also other things, but yeah, that's a kind of a broad kind of starting point of these benefits. But again, I think they're really dependent on the whole context.
Yeah.
Yeah. They don't automatically manifest. And I've been seeing that, unfortunately, quite a lot. People kind of like expecting those benefits, and that kind of also affecting the whole process as well.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. It's kind of an extractive process. I have this thing now. I want to take this substance and I'll be kind of good. And yeah, that's usually approaching psychedelics with this mindset or attitude is not always most recommended.
Mm-hmm. I mean, what you just said is, in my view, also true for spiritual experience to a large extent, right? I mean, you usually, it opens you up like a spiritual experience. Like many people talk about like a heightened sense of meaning, a deeper sense of interconnectedness to other people, to nature, and so on. So would you say that psychedelics kind of instigate spiritual experiences?
Well, now it's a big question. Depends a lot on how we also kind of define spirituality and what we mean by all of this. But looking, I mean, there are, let's put it like that, from the point of view of the literature and of the studies being done, there's a very clear correlation, especially like the reference landmark studies done by Roland Griffiths from John Hopkins. And basically looking at psilocybin and I don't remember off the top of my head, but a very high percentage of the participants in the study reported the experience as being either the most meaningful or amongst the top five most meaningful and deep and spiritual experiences of their life, their experience with a high dose of psilocybin. Here, and personally what I would say, something like, I don't think the psychedelic creates a spiritual experience, but I would say more that whatever is spiritual in you can be awakened or deepened or potentiated by the psychedelic. That's when done alone. And of course, then if we look at, if we do it in a spiritual setting as well, as let's say many people nowadays, they're fascinated by something like ayahuasca and want to go in the Amazon and do it with an indigenous tribe, that's part of a spiritual ceremony. So it kind of, there also the set and setting can influence the perception of the whole experience. So I would guess it's varied, as it's mostly is with yeah. these things.
But when you mention taking ayahuasca in countries like Brazil or Mexico, in maybe a shamanic setting, we're also talking about a massive tourist market at the moment, I see, right?
Mm-hmm.
There's an industry attracting mostly young, I guess, Western tourists, hungry for experiences, to come to Mexico or Brazil or wherever and get your ayahuasca trip, right?
Yes, very, very much so. It became, you know, like if we talk about, you know, there are also kind of these spiritual places for young people. For example, in India, Rishikesh would be a place like that.
Yeah.
You know, there's kind of a whole industry around it. The same is like, you know, you can say in Peru, the Iquito, it's the same. It's like the whole economy of the you know, small town or the village is kind of focused around it. And I think there's a big, I mean, obviously there's the curiosity of the people, there's these practices. I don't want to say that all that are doing that or all those providers are not okay or there's a problem with it. But unfortunately, there's a lot of danger because most of them do not, in the interest of making a profit, do not kind of necessarily take all the safety precautions. And also the people, they don't pre-screen necessarily the people. And as I said, psychedelics are really, can be beneficial for some people, but can be really chaotic and harmful for some others. And, you know, the stories that you rarely hear, you know, I don't want to be the doomsayer, but sometimes, you know, it can happen that someone, you know, in Peru on ayahuasca has, you know, decapitated someone else during a retreat or something like that. And that's, of course, puts things into perspective. And we also need to think also about the impact it has on the indigenous people there and on how, like, we're kind of trying to, in a way, exploit the culture a little bit as well. But yeah, that's not to say that one cannot have also profound and a new and enriching experience like that.
Yeah. I didn't want to say that either. One of the interesting twists in the history of modern spirituality and the history of modern psychedelics as well is that both stories are closely linked, right? Mm. And you can see that in a figure like Richard Alpern, who did LSD research with Timothy Leary at Harvard University in the 1960s, and later became the famous guru Ram Dass. So what is it in your view, and maybe in your own experience, that connects psychedelics and spirituality so closely, maybe in more respects than just the closeness of the direct experience?
Well, that's a deep question in certain ways. For both, meaning is kind of very important. And my main kind of view also psychedelics in certain ways that it can be also seen as a tool is not, it's a crude approximation, but as something, you know, a non-specific amplifier, that would be kind of a more scientific, let's say, approach to it. And I think that it is likely in circles of people that kind of want to find out more about themselves, want to discover, are also maybe perhaps influenced by Eastern spirituality or ideas, that there will be kind of the opening to welcome and invite such tools as psychedelics. And I think it's just they would attract similar kind of personalities or hopes or dreams. And I think that's why they're also kind of linked, and there are also kind of historical reasons for that with also the freedom and kind of progressive and freedom searching movement in the 60s in the United States. And I think there was also ideology and spiritual ideals and ideas imported that came over and kind of influenced that. And I think psychedelics were also like important tools and important kind of amplifiers of these messages. So that's how I would see kind of like they're both kind of the similarities and also like the way they're related in other ways as well.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. You agreed that we could speak about your personal experiences as well.
Yes.
And you also combine psychedelics and spirituality in your life.
Yes. Perhaps it makes most sense, you know, to also like from my first person research and observations over the last 10 years. I mean, yes, I could say I was almost not at all spiritual before having my first psychedelic experience. And I ended up, and I can explain how, but I ended up from working in strategy consulting in London, like an 80-hour work week. I ended up less than 6 months afterwards in a Buddhist monastery in Nepal at the foothills of the Himalayas. So I guess in my case, one can see that there's a clear correlation there between psychedelics and spirituality. But then also like with how things later on evolved in my life, I kind of came to understand that the psychedelic was in a way searching for something numinous. In my case, let me just maybe narrate this and it will make sense. So I didn't take psychedelics to experience something spiritual to begin with. So I was in London. I was a strategy consultant at that time. And I was not well. Even though my life outwardly went fine, had a very good job, I had a partner, I was actually, now I realize I was depressed and hadn't smiled in many months at that time. And I did a bit of reading around and I found out that, I mean, at that time I wasn't unfortunately open to psychotherapy. I didn't have the emotional maturity for that. I was kind of closed and didn't trust. So I kind of said, okay, what else could I do? And I said, I saw there's like good research on MDMA and other psychedelics as well, but I just focused on MDMA, had one experience, kind of like researched how to do it properly, la, la, la. And, well, I had some prejudices about these substances, obviously, as many of us have, and experience felt like I felt like I could be me and happy again, and it felt absolutely amazing, and kind of the more kind of direct marks of depression almost immediately went away. So that kind of made me okay, there's definitely more to all these substances that was told to me. So that's when I became interested in psychedelics as more of like, okay, what's, because people seem to say that like things get even much, much, much deeper than MDMA. And I was like, okay, how is this possible? I still didn't know how. So I started experimenting with mescaline and with LSD. But initially in normal doses, I had very meaningful experiences. I quit smoking weed after my first mescaline experience. And I came into touch with, let's say, what it feels to be like at the edge of like timelessness, have some feelings of unity, have a sense of like having almost at that time out of body experiences, but not full, but still not enough, kind of not, it was still all very new. So I didn't have a framework where to integrate it. So I didn't really know what to make of these experiences. And then unfortunately or unfortunately, depending on how we, on the different lenses of interpretation that I have of this, I had one experience that really changed everything dramatically in my life, because at that time I ordered from the dark net, as only source to source something like that at that time. And the person that sent them to me mislabeled the large doses from the micro doses, because I ordered two. And on one evening, in which I was a horrible set and setting, alone after a fight with my ex-partner in a bad mind state, I decided to take, that time I thought would be 100 micrograms of LSD, which I hoped would kind of help me. I don't know, I was in distress. I really don't know. It wouldn't have made so much sense to do it, but I did it. Well, the thing is, unbeknownst to me, that was not 100 micrograms, because the person switched the 10 micrograms and 120 microgram blotters. And I ended up taking well over 1,000 micrograms of LSD. And for those that don't know, that's really a lot. And what happened basically, it was terrifying, because I was losing my mind and I didn't know why. Because that was the more, if I knew that this happened, but I didn't know, and things started to go, like I started to feel that I'm going absolutely insane. I cannot make sense of anything. At some point, I couldn't see my hand in front of my face, and I was sure, absolutely sure I was going to die. And I kind of prepared for that. And
as much as you could in that state.
As much as I, yes, I just had a picture of that time. Of my family and like a nice small plushy toy. And I took them somehow in bed with me. And I kind of said, okay, if they're going to find me dead, at least, you know, to feel that there was, you know, something good in my last thoughts. Because I was kind of I brought pride to my family with also with what I did before and my achievements and, you know, like the stigma of like finding him dead after what they would have seen just a drug overdose, you know, it would have been a bit, you know, not that great.
No.
So interesting that even in those states of absolute deconstruction of reality, you know, everything, this was on my mind.
Yeah. That's super interesting. Yeah.
No. And yeah, that from the moment in which I let go and I accepted that this is my last breath, and an experience, absolutely fascinating experience, ensued with kind of a tunnel of clear light and kind of breaking free of my body, time, space, and being somewhere where I could kind of access moments from the past, all my kind of biography till birth, and also like what seemed to be, I mean, I have no way of knowing if it was more of my past lives, but seemed to have been instances of at least some past life, if not mine, but with the level of detail and luxury of experience, it wasn't just a kind of a projection of my mind. That was, I think, consciousness experienced those things, whether it was my consciousness or that's speculation.
Yeah.
And also I could kind of see how this reality, I mean, this kind of, which we're talking right now, is kind of like formed. And at some point I got spit out of this kind of like universal unity soup of past, present, future back into my body. And the experience lasted for much longer after then, but that was kind of the acute phase. And it took me many, many years to really integrate all the insights and what I witnessed and what I understood about the nature of life, death, meaning. Yeah, I kind of, all my beliefs, pretty much all my beliefs, or most of my beliefs, were kind of shattered overnight. And yeah, what followed was an interesting integration journey.
You tried Tibetan Buddhism, right?
Yes, that's basically like after looking through a lot of things, like, is there anyone, anything that talks about these things, or like seriously, you know, not because I was very serious. I had a good memory even before, and I was sure that this was there was something real and something that felt very real and deep there, and I couldn't ignore. And I found out indeed that an experience of Tibetan yogis in retreat, so this just for context would be people who do 10, 20, 30 year retreats in the Himalayas and kind of have developed intricate systems and practices. And there they talk about, let's say, the elements that my experience had. And there that was not something, uncommon. And that's why I started to study, and that's why I went then to Nepal as well. And I started, let's say, my spiritual search at that time.
And how did you make sense of your very strong psychedelic experience in the framework of maybe Tibetan Buddhism or what you found there?
So basically, there's a big difference into how I made sense initially and like the integration journey that kind of lasted many years afterwards. And I kind of got many kind of new insights and tips and ways to kind of like make this into a whole. But initially, basically, what was most reassuring is that I have not kind of, I didn't go, let's say, proverbially crazy. I don't like to use this term, but there are people who have talked about this experience, this kind of space of the bardo between kind of life and death, and kind of with the descriptions of this space of that it's absolutely okay to have an out-of-body experience and not something that it's totally unreal. So kind of more, it was a lot of validation of the reality of these things, for which in my culture, in my upbringing or kind of knowledge, there were no reference, so to speak.
Yeah.
So validation in that sense. And also I think it's the emphasis on Buddhism, emphasis on compassion and love kind of was the first step for me to actually also open my heart, because unbeknownst to me, but my heart was not really open. At that time, I was a very competitive young man. And whilst obviously I had feelings and everything, but I realized at that time that, you know, like almost overnight, I became a vegetarian and I started to kind of change many behaviors. I'm not anymore a full vegetarian, but I was for 7 years. And it's kind of like all these, I wish I would have had maybe a more gradual kind of discovery of these things, because it's not like I'd never thought of having such a high dose. At that time, I even thought, you know, maybe 10, 15 years from now, I'll be ready. So I felt like it was all on like hard, like, bam, 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 you have to do this, that, this, and now. But I definitely felt I felt I had a backing with the help of also connecting to the Tibetan Buddhist lineage, connecting to someone in Nepal who was also a Tibetan yogi, and also to the Sangha, to the community of practitioners that was definitely a big help.
What do you mean by backing? Do you mean like the experience was backing your spiritual practice, or the spiritual practice and framework was backing your integration of the psychedelic experience?
I mean, in a way, both ways, and also in a way that's, you know, let's put it like that. If, and this is a bit, let's say, more mystical, what I'm going to say now, or more like that's difficult to grasp, but if for those that never had a psychedelic experience or a very deep spiritual experience might make less sense, but for those that had, you know, in the space that you can go, especially if you, let's say, if you have a unity experience or out-of-body experience, there's a space in which you have no, it's a very strange and unfamiliar place and can feel very daunting and difficult and challenging and alone and lonely. And I would say that at a subtle level, being connected to a community of practitioners who had access and realizations in these different states of consciousness made me feel more supported. Whether it was just through kind of, let's say, a placebo belief that, you know, I'm not there, or whether there was some actual, you know, presence there, it's hard to say, but I could definitely feel it. Yeah.
So it was the aspect of community that really helped you.
Yes, yes, the aspect of community and the aspect of like having this, the maps and the structures also of like the experience and like what comes after what, you know, like the even the concept of the dark night of the soul, or, you know, like having a map to states of consciousness was super valuable.
But the dark night of the soul comes from Juan de la Cruz, right?
Yes,
that is,
yes,
that
correct,
is Christian
correct.
In the end.
Correct.
But can you give an example of, a sort of map, maybe, that Tibetan Buddhism gave you?
Mm-hmm. So I think it was from a very like simple, my contact with Vipassana as well, you know, the importance, you know, of Sila, Samadhi, Panya. So basically like having, you know, having the ethics, the morality, having the training in concentration, and then kind of developing the insight practices. And that would be one thing. Then another one that was also, I mean, pivotal would be understanding the different, also like, let's say, realms of being / states of consciousness. That was also very useful. Then the concept of a bardo and kind of like intermediary gap and the kind of transition phases were also very helpful.
Can you give a quick definition of bardo for people who don't know?
Yes, so bardo in its very kind of direct sense is like an intermediary gap. It can be kind of an intermediary gap, but it is most widely used, you know, in the bardo of kind of crossing from life, from being alive to being dead. And there are different kind of, the Tibetans have a very deep kind of cosmology and kind of structural system of the different bardos, but it's kind of like, let's say, if we think, you know, in Christianity we have, you know, we have, I'm not at all far from being an expert, but I mean, there's the idea of being like on earth, and then there's an idea of heaven, but, you know, maybe there's purgatory, but there's no, you know, in my view, you know, I couldn't kind of resonate with the idea of heaven, because that's also very interesting, because I was brought up as a Christian Orthodox, and in those last moments when I was preferring to die, I was like, well, okay, if there's a God now, I mean, please help me. It's like I'm in real distress. And I was like, okay, like I was having a conception of like heaven and hell, and it's kind of, but what ensued and what was like the phenomenology of what was happening to me afterwards did not correspond at all to that. But kind of the explanation of the bardos made much more sense, you know. It's like a place where, you know, all of a sudden, you know, you can be in white, surrounded by white light and absolute like nothingness. And then afterwards you can go into biographical kind of like journeys throughout different moments of your life. And then you can go to kind of meet unfathomable beings and strange, mm-hmm. you know, mazes of kaleidoscopic luminosity, and, you know, it can be super intense. And that was not kind of so much presented. And if I, in Christianity, and if I now, if I'm allowed to make, and this is kind of a, I don't know if Terence McKenna made it or if I kind of came with the thought or someone else, but I found it a good representation, you know, the heaven and hell part from Christianity is like, if you die with, let's say, an unhappy heart and with a heavy heart, then, you know, the experience would feel like hell. And because it would be in the causal state of consciousness, it would feel like it's forever. So before entering that kind of tunnel of light and having this blissful experience, it was absolutely a hellish experience for me. And it felt forever because there was no sense of time. So I can maybe kind of Christianity is referring to heaven and hell as the kind of immediate steps actually before dying. And then what happens afterwards is like, it's a mystery in that sense. And that's, I could unlock, but it's personally for me a bit of that mystery with the help of Tibetan Buddhism and then like other spiritual traditions. But I think on the topic of death, which was I had a huge, very big fear of dying ever from a child. And kind of there was also after that experience, which was in my mind also a near-death experience, kind of this fascination. And then I could find the most materials in the Tibetan.
And then was this fear of dying lifted from you after this experience?
Yes, it was lifted in a very dramatic way for about 6 months, maybe a little bit more. It was completely absent, which I would say that for, let's say, psychological and physical integrity of the human body, it's not ideal at all. So I got in, I easily could put myself in dangerous situations.
Yeah.
Mostly with either to help other people or in other circumstances, but yeah, it was really not there, not at all.
Mm-hmm.
And then it gradually came back, but not in the sense, you know, let's put it like that, cognitively, like on a cognitive and kind of more disembodied perspective, I think I do not fear that. And kind of if I were to like, it's not something that I fear in that sense. I understand personally for me what kind of this means and what probably will ensue and how I need to prepare and la la la. But that doesn't mean that now if someone walks out into this room now and puts a gun at my head, that my body will not feel it. I will start to shake. I will start to kind of, all a lot of fears would come up. So I think that's also kind of a mark of also kind of how much of this realization is embodied. And I think honestly, for some of the teachers, some of the people that I've met, maybe for some of them, even if someone would come now with a gun, there would be no, you know, if they would be monitored, you know, with their physical symptoms, there would be no critical. Yeah.
Yeah. They would still be, even physically and physiologically, they would remain calm and quiet.
I'm calm in a traffic jam, you know. There are day-to-day activities and situations which, let's say, this insight has helped a lot and very calm. But still, I realized that it's actually good to appreciate life and not to kind of just... I kind of could have easily also in the first 2 years identified myself more with, let's say, these higher, quote-unquote, states of consciousness, this disembodied state of consciousness. And the more I would be in those states through practice or with psychedelics, the more I would feel like, yeah, this life is, you know, it's samsara. It's like, you know, it's a play. It's lila. It's the play. It's not real. But I realized for my own personal integration and for my own, let's say, embodiment, lack of dissociation and kind of eco-social political engagement with the world, it's not a helpful, let's say, lens. And I discovered that in the last 4 years, especially. That it's like, if I'm alive, I should kind of be as embodied as I can and be here.
And not escape to higher states of consciousness.
And not escape, exactly. Even though they could, like, the pleasure, let's say, I mean, I've tried most of the pleasurable things in human life. And, I mean, these states in terms of, like, felt sense of pleasure and happiness and everything are beat any sort of like it's standard human experience that they could think it's absolutely amazing. And there is a temptation, there is a strong temptation. But yeah, at the same time, it's It's also like, I don't know, here it's also like a matter of belief, but I'm not sure, you know, some people are very convinced, you know, that they came into this physical body with a mission and it's, they have to do X, Y, Z. I'm not fully convinced of that. I do believe that there is some sense into that, but I think, you know, also in the last few years, the deepest richness I felt was when both, let's say, my spirituality was manifested through myself and through my kind of imperfect self and the self that, you know, is not rid of all problems, you know, in a disembodied state where I'm absolutely fine and everything is great. No, it's like, how is it when, you know, how do I tend to my wounded inner child, or how do I deal with interpersonal relationships? And that's, you know, that's where sometimes spiritual teachings are not so helpful there. Some.
I mean, as I understood it, all the serious spiritual teachers remark or underline very strongly that if your spiritual practice doesn't help you in your everyday life, it's no use.
Exactly.
So you have to bring your spiritual life and your everyday life together.
Trust, I mean, I've had these experiences as a 22-year-old initially. How much can you know as a 22-year-old? So I failed, and I've bumped into many kind of dead ends, and I kind of felt I've lived through spiritual bypassing. I lived through all sorts of like dissociating and kind of learning. And obviously I come now with a great insight, you know, that my practice needs to be more embodied. And, you know, like what all these teachers have been saying, you know, like Jack Kornfield, yeah, first the ecstasy, then the laundry. And, yeah, you know, it's so obvious, but then like, no, it's also fascinating. I'm 22. I can, you know, like I also had like all these kind of things that, oh my God, all of now I have all these kind of like wisdom now. And like, you know, it definitely, like, let's say I had these strong ego that experiences, but I think my spiritual ego got very bumped initially and didn't serve me, didn't make me a nicer person to be around, for some, for sure not.
Yeah. And I think one thought that's really interesting is that you remarked that your fear of death eventually came back after the experience, after months later. And it's a valuable feeling, right? Because it helps us to survive, right? And it's we should not, the goal of a spiritual practice should not be to completely and forever overcome the fear of death, but maybe to kind of embrace it and kind of respect it and maybe even love it, and in that way approach it and maybe take the sting out of it.
Oh yeah, I totally agree with that. And I think also in this process, to be perfectly fair, I think it also morphs, because I wouldn't say like the same fear of that is still present. It kind of morphs more into a deep appreciation for life, you know, and also the impermanence of life,
yeah,
and the how much effort and all the blessings and all the efforts of my parents, my forefathers, and all that had to come into being, all the natural resources, everything that came into being so that I am here where I am. So it's more kind of like an appreciation for that, and like not wanting to lose that just like that, and to squander that, and to want to fight to keep that alive. Yes. I would say that has changed. And yeah, I agree with you. I don't think the point is to just fully escape it. And because if I think, the reason why I didn't have in that period a fear of death is that I was still in, let's say, not in the gross realm, fully present. I was dissociated in a, let's say, if one wants to call it high, I don't even know if I was a higher state of consciousness. It was a disembodied, more disembodied state of consciousness where I already kind of, probably due to the trauma of the experience as well, I kind of, thought I was still dead. And I was like, okay, if I already died, there's no point to fear that.
All right. So now that you're older and much more mature, what do you do today? What is your spiritual practice and maybe your psychedelic practice nowadays?
So I think a lot has changed, because the first 2 years, obviously, I was more, I mean, most of my practice also, it was, I discovered meditation, but there was also like a a lot of psychedelic experimentation, and then afterwards I decided, okay, I need to learn how to. There was this idea of to not be dependent on substances for my, let's say, practices, and that's when I went deeper into meditation, into yoga, into breath work, which I kind of continued as a daily practice ever since. And also for me, the practice of lucid dreaming was the practice with which I came to have some of my most deepest and most amazing also spiritual experiences. And it's, let's say, the most accessible, natural way to access altered, profoundly altered states of consciousness that I would recommend anyone interested in these things to have a look at. And now, I'm still open to the idea of having psychedelics, but I view them as something that would either, like, if I'm stuck in my practice, or if I'm at a place where I can't seem to kind of, I try to kind of get unstuck or find a different practice or something to move forward, and I cannot, then it, in most cases, it has been useful as either giving the right insight or raising the energy or giving me enough courage or kind of breaking, so to speak, the band. There is, let's say, there's this like an elastic band, you know, of more tension. And I'm kind of caught in that tension, and I don't have the strength to break the band, but maybe with an experience that would kind of break the band, and then I can kind of focus on the integration of it.
And to break the band, like a psychedelic, can be helpful.
It can. If used properly in the right context, it can help with that. Because also, like, if we look, there's also been studied in the relaxed belief under psychedelic, the rebus model, it basically limits, this was also why it's helpful in therapy, because let's say we form a lot of like deeply ingrained beliefs, and they become rigid. And psychedelics, also by the way they work in the brain as well, they kind of help relaxing these beliefs. And then with more relaxed beliefs, you can, more easily see, oh, there is this perspective of, oh, I actually can let go of that hurt, or, oh, that doesn't serve me at all, or, oh, it's very scary and painful, but I have to accept it. And I think it at least it did help me and many others that I've spoken, and I've also, like, in the workshops that I led and in the people that I've met over the years. Yeah, I think that's something for which there is use.
So I would call it an increase in mental flexibility.
Yes, psychological flexibility, mental flexibility. Yeah, yeah,
yeah,
yeah. But also with what I'm discovering now, and in the last few years, and I'm trying to see, like, psychedelics also have a high capacity of inducing false thoughts, delusions, and of giving you the sense that you're making more progress than you actually are.
Yeah.
And I've been played by that. And now that's why I'm developing also my own integration protocol, is trying to kind of address this issue and trying to have, you know, for example, I mean, I'm not going to go into detail, but having, you know, after each experience, having like a write-up of what has happened, of the insights and of the messages and of the action points that I want to make, and of kind of a checklist of what needs to be accomplished or needs to be resolved until there's any sense for me to have another experience. And if I wouldn't kind of tick off those marks, so to speak, I know that if I have the experience, it's more from escapist motivations rather than from, okay, this actually, there might actually be like a really deeper calling in a sense here. But just to make it absolutely clear for people, you really do not need psychedelics to have a spiritual practice or to develop spiritually. Or if tomorrow I would find out that there would be no more psychedelics, sure, I wouldn't be super elated or happy, but it would be all right, because I have the tools and the ways to kind of get in touch with myself without. But in the first 2 years of my journey, if you'd have told me, okay, from tomorrow there you have no more access to psychedelics, I would have freaked out a little bit. Mm-hmm. And that signals also to me that there was although there is no classical addiction to psychedelics, as in, you know, with cocaine or with stimulants or opiates, there was a psychological addiction for sure.
Mm-hmm.
Because it was giving me the capacity to enter states and capacities also of mind and of intelligence and of flexibility that were otherwise not accessible and that I had to work hard over the years to somehow integrate.
Mm-hmm. And what does your spiritual practice look like in your everyday life these days?
So I think I have some influences. I think right now there's influence obviously from Buddhism, especially something like Dzogchen, and I'm trying to kind of. For years I've realized I've been very split because I had, you know, had my life whilst meditating or whilst doing a practice, and then my life otherwise. And I realized that even though like both, I mean, my practice was increasing in capacity or whatever, whatnot, it wasn't really like I was feeling I was being split. And right now, I would say in the last year, I've been focusing a lot on not having this distinction. So right now, it's part of my spiritual practice as well.
To not have the split
between I'm now on the meditation pillow and I'm now kind of like, you know, going on the street and walking on the street, or mm-hmm. I'm now in the podcast with you.
Mm-hmm.
So kind of trying to like let's say the realizations and the insights that I've in peak state experiences that I come to believe as, let's say, they form my belief system.
Yeah.
To be able to enact them in every moment as much as possible, and when not, to observe and to kind of integrate it in the moment. Because before I realized there was a slight, you know, like when I was in spiritual mode on, so mm-hmm. to speak,
yeah.
you know, I would be like super spiritual or kind of super in line with these things. But when that would not be on, either because people would not be looking or whatnot, I would revert to kind of like more basic and crude ways of dealing with things that were not in line. And that also, especially like as a deeper level, also being a facilitator and working with people and leading workshops and sessions. And I realized, well, as a big problem, if I am in a certain way, you know, like you see me, you know, been to one of the workshops I did, you know, you see me there and then you see me like in day-to-day life and I'm a very different person, you know, in civilian uniform, so to speak, that creates a split and that's not healthy. So even though that implies, you know, like let's say the average, so my average behavior would be lower than the peaks, it's more authentic and it creates less neuroticism mm-hmm. in my day-to-day life.
I think what you just said is also a beautiful reminder of why peak experiences in a completely religious or spiritual practice or setting can be dangerous, is precisely because they get you out of your everyday consciousness, which feels really good, which feels makes you feel proud and kind of maybe elevated above the everyday. But if you grasp onto them, right, if you identify with them, they become really dangerous. And I think that is one of the reasons why many Buddhist teachers that I know don't really speak about these deep spiritual states. Like, for example, jhanas in Theravada Buddhism, yes. That's like the path or kind of the tradition of Buddhism that I'm most closely associated or most closely linked to. And I mean, what you said like illustrates that beautifully, how it feels great and it can be really helpful, but it comes with its pitfalls and dangers.
Yeah, that's why honestly, like I've now with occasions like this, like a podcast and like sharing these experiences from the past, I talk about it, but normally I would like talk much, much less. Like I honestly, like I even like tell people that ask me about it that it's I can sense, you know, if the question is out of genuine curiosity for the phenomenology of the experience, it's a different thing. But I can sense in some, it's like, no, I want to get there. I want to have that now. And then I tend to not even speak about it so much because I know this will lead to the same, you know, I'm not saying from a place, I mean, I've made all these mistakes and I'm pretty sure it's not helpful. And that's why I would not kind of advocate. And, you know, I think most Buddhist teachers would agree that, you know, these states and in different jhanas and in the different, you know, cities also that might come along with these states, cities being kind of these, let's say, special paranormal powers almost, they're just kind of manifestations and symptoms of the, let's say, awakening journey, and one should not take them too seriously. Yeah.
Yeah. All right. So I would say we could summarize the message as don't get stuck in your peak experiences.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Yes, I think that's a good way of putting it. So like, or something like, you know, when the trip ends, the journey continues.
Ah, that's a nice phrase. I like that.
Yeah, that's also yeah, and that, you know, you can do not get identified with your peak experience self, as in do not think that you're like that all the time. Do definitely I would say it's good to see, okay, yes, you are interconnected with everyone else. Yes, nature is part of you. Yes, keep those insights, but realize that you might not in every day-to-day activity be like that. And if, you know, you realize, okay, you know, in the peak state experience, I love all animals, all living beings. It's tragic to eat meat and especially poorly farmed, etc. But then, you know, if you use in your day-to-day that you're not quite there, and if you have to use 80% of your mental energy to just kind of kill all the impulses from your body that tell you to eat that, maybe that's also something to consider and kind of be more gentle also, especially because new standards are being set. And it's very easy for us, especially in the West, that are kind of used to kind of pushing ourselves and excelling and competing, to kind of not be gentle with ourselves. I'm failed. I'm such a terrible person, you know, because I know these truths and yet I cannot live in accordance with them. So yeah, more gentleness with ourselves and what we can and cannot do.
That's also a nice loop back to the beginning of our talk when you said that one of the important discoveries that you had on your journey into Tibetan Buddhism was compassion, and compassion with yourself and opening up your heart, right?
Yes, very, very much so. And also like on that, that's curious because there were all those insights in that important big experience for me. There were all those insights and all those visions and all those things, but there was only one real strong, very loud message that was being broadcast. And it was kind of like, I've kind of recycled this story and it's these memories so much over the years that I'm not myself sure that if the message was only love is real or love is super important, take very much care of love, this is the focus on love. And yeah, kind of that stuck with me, and it's not easy, especially because at the beginning, you know, I was like, okay, having to love all human beings, and that's very hard.
It's
hard to really do in practice, and I kind of like my love for, let's say, for people like outside of my family and friends and known people kind of increased. But because I didn't have the capacity to sustain that, I realized that my actual love and consideration for the people close to me got lower. And that's why kind of like I would say, and I would advise people who work with these practices, like if you cannot do it with the people also like close to you, like start there, start with yourself and the people close to you and gradually kind of increase. Because it's very tempting to now, okay, yes, I'm, you know, classic awakening, but yes, I mean, we're all one. Yes, we're Osama bin Laden and we're like terrorists and horrible people. Yes, but maybe it makes sense to start with ourselves and our family.
Your immediate surroundings.
yes.
I mean, it's also...
friends and...
Like your immediate surroundings are the area where your influence is the greatest, right?
Yes, exactly. That's where we're not that powerless.
Exactly. Yeah. So let me maybe ask you a final question, and that is the question of my podcast, which in German is Was glaubst du denn? So, is there anything you believe in?
Well, if it's a matter of belief, yes, I do believe that at least I and many people who held like a materialist reductionist view of life and death are wrong, in the sense that death is not nearly the end in the way that that was assumed, and that consciousness cannot really die, even though like our body, yes, the physical body will die and decay. Consciousness pervades. That's what I believe, yes. And I also believe in a kind of participatory mystery of unfolding of reality, that not everything is fully deterministic and set in place. There are some kind of chords and rhythms, like divine chords and rhythms of life. But I do think that kind of we're influencing with our own consciousness. We're kind of co-shaping this reality as we move along. And I also have this belief that in 10, 20 years from now, the insight about consciousness, not kind of ending in the moment of death, I don't think will be a belief anymore. It's leaving it with a strong statement.
All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Das war's für heute von Was glaubst du denn? Dem Podcast über die Vielfalt des spirituellen Lebens. Ich hoffe, es hat euch gefallen. Wenn ihr meine Arbeit unterstützen wollt, könnt ihr mir gerne über den Link in den Shownotes eine Spende zukommen lassen. Ich danke euch fürs Zuhören und freue mich schon aufs nächste Mal. Und für den schönen Titeltrack geht mein Dank an die sehr gute Band Phantom Horse.